everyone. Welcome to this week's episode of Energy in Action. I'm your host, Stephanie, and our podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Zogenics. Here on Energy in Action, we talk all things Mito, and our goal is to be entertaining and informative. And today's episode is definitely a great combination of both. I am speaking with Mito Canada. I'd like to introduce you to Kate Murray, the CEO, and joining her is the Chief Development Officer, Catherine Mulville. Mito Canada, our partners to the north, have made some exciting changes to their organization, and they have a lot of great things happening. So tell me a little bit about yourselves and how you guys got to Mito Canada.
Sure. Would you like me to kick off?
Sure. Go ahead, Kate.
Great. So I co-lead Mito Canada with Catherine Mulville, who's, again, our Chief Development Officer. Mito Canada was looking for a new leader, and Catherine and I felt with our combined skills, not-for-profit experience, and I'd say unique talents in growing small organizations, that a co-leadership model would be ideal for Mito Canada. And it's really difficult for one individual to be able to fill all the needs of an organization. And I think with a co-leadership model, we have the ability to do that. We can fulfill those objectives and support the organization in its next evolution. Combined, I would say Catherine and I probably have 40 years experience in foundation development, fundraising, patient support, program development, awareness, advocacy, the list goes on.
Where did you two come from? Like to get
before? Yeah, well, there's a lengthy story. So I'm no stranger to Mito Canada. I've worked for the organization in many different capacities in the past for about 4 years collectively. And as you know, small organizations, we all wear many hats. But for the large part of my career has been in the field of gastroenterology and nutrition. I worked for the Canadian Digestive Health Foundation as their Vice President of Partners and Programs, their Director of Research and Patient Programs. Before life in the not-for-profit world, I worked for one of the largest brands in the world, Coca-Cola Enterprises. My area of focus was business development, distribution, and asset management. I kind of joke, I used to make people sick. Now I like to make people healthy.
Yeah, that's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. I'm also the founder of a national children's charity, which focuses on rapid access to therapeutics that aren't covered under provincial and private health plans. I also have a son who's 19 years old, and he lives with a complex chronic illness and has since he was 5. So he has lived life longer with his disease and doesn't remember life without it. So,
wow.
So certainly bring lots of different lenses and perspectives and experiences to the leadership role that Catherine and I hold. And I think that really, that again, plays to the strengths of, you know, being able to draw upon those past experience from that diverse background to problem solve, set priorities, be able to connect with people in different ways, understanding the power of collaboration and partnership.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And wow, you do bring a huge, great bag of tricks with you. Awesome. Okay.
Now I just tagged along with her.
You just tagged along.
Not true. Kate and I have known each other for quite some time. We used to work, I used to actually be the executive director for the Canadian Digestive Health Foundation for 10 years. So we met when we were working together there. And became friends actually. And when the opportunity for Mito Canada came along, it seemed like a good opportunity to do that. So similar but different to Kate's background. I have a degree in physical education and English. So I joke that I can write and run, or used to be able to anyways. I had a rare disease when I was 30 that I had a 10% chance of surviving. And that sort of led me into the not-for-profit world. I changed my focus from for-profit marketing and communications into not-for-profit. When I founded my first charity, which was called Strategies for Life, and that led to a whole bunch of different things, including working in the non-for-profit sector. So my skill set really is looking at organizations that are either in crisis or in transition. And Mito Canada is definitely one that's in transition, not in, in crisis at all. They've got a 10-year history behind them where they've done some incredible work. Wow. And 10 years looking forward is what we're looking at now, is how do we actually move the organization forward. So I'm going to draw on my skills from developing programs, major fundraisings. I've been responsible for raising over $30 million for different organizations, including some of my own. So I've also founded another charity called Global Friends that supports about 10,000 kids in Africa. So together we're kind of eclectic, but I think at the heart of everything that both of us do is really compassion and caring, and what do we do to help people who are in need or want to help other people.
Excellent. We have so much in common. I have a son who has Mito, and we've been in this now for 21 years. So I feel like I'm a little bit of a veteran on, you know, how to navigate this. Had I had social media at the beginning of our adventure, I think my life would have been a whole lot easier, because I would have been able to plug in with other parents and say, what do I do? Mm-hmm. So,
I think that's a really important point, because, you know, as time has gone by, because when I was sick, which was almost 25 years ago, like the internet didn't exist, and trying to find the year that I had my illness, so I had flesh eating disease, there were 58 people on the planet who had it that year. So trying to find someone who had it and be able to share stories and, you know, how do we protect other people was a really big challenge. So I think social media is something that we can use to our advantage. I think there's lots of bad things about it, but there's some really powerful, it's a really powerful tool. So I think that's a really great point.
Yeah, it's, I found my voice with that at Global Genes a few years ago, listening to the social media director for the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And he, same scenario, had a child 25 years ago with something so rare and was given, you know, just that horrible prognosis. And he said, all I wanted to do was talk to one other dad and just know that I was going to survive this. And he said, I couldn't find another dad, obviously. And so that really spurred him into, how do we make this social media world for good? So, and I too have started my own charity foundation, and it's for, because my son was wheelchair bound, and we had found this organization that makes wheelchairs that just go anywhere. They just have like little caterpillar tracks on the side. So if you want to go on a dirt road, if you want to go on the beach, wherever you want to go, you can go. And so we called it GOT, Get Out There. And we helped families raise money for their chairs, with the exception of, if you raised more than what you needed for your action chair, then you put it into like our kitty or our pot, and then we would seed other people, like, okay, we'll start you off with, you know, $2,000, now go get the rest. Or they'd say, oh, we're $2,000 short. We would, okay, let's get you there. And just kind of that whole crowdfunding thing, just a little bit more organized. And so with powerful. A specific thing, it was, and again, it connected people with all varying reasons for mobility issues, and it just kind of created this whole network of, oh, you went there. How did you get there? What did you do? And I just loved watching people connect, because I know what it's like to sit in my blanket fort alone. And so that's why it brought me to Mito Action, was helping people know that their stories are important. And we're finding here in the U.S., as patients become more vocal and learn to tell their stories, that the doctors are realizing that the patients are the experts. They have written the protocols and the survival guides, and you know, how they get around certain things, and how important it is to bring your story together and to say it out loud. And once you say it out loud, the fear goes away somewhat, and you feel stronger and you feel more confident about what you're doing. So
for sure. And they're the subject matter experts. They live with it day in and day out. So why would we not lean to them for those insights? Because they're so valuable.
So valuable. And I learn something every day from our population here in, well, mostly North America. Just every day of, you have this disorder. I mean, we've all heard of, you know, there's like the top 25 mitochondrial disorders, right? And then there's this plethora of others. And no two kids are alike. You cannot put two mito kids in the same room with the same disease and say there's, mm-hmm. yep, you guys look alike. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. And so it's so wonderful to hear how people have managed or figured out or just the resources that they have found or adapted. So mm-hmm. that's what I love. It's like just that whole stick-to-itness. Yeah, that network. And I you got to get through it. So
I'm sure. And I think you're right. You know, that it's the individuals who are living with the diseases, but also those who care for them, mm-hmm. you know, whether that's a brother, a sister, a wife, a husband, a grandmother, the neighbor, the best mm-hmm. friend, you know, there are so many creative and compassionate people out there. And my experience has been that the more people suffer, the more they're willing and make room to help.
Oh, I agree.
Right. Because being diagnosed with a rare disorder, a rare disease, whether it's chronic or acute, means that you need to adapt, and you need to adapt fast. And people are just so amazing at doing that. And yet, you know, even though we may all fall under the mitochondria umbrella, you're right. Every individual, it's just like we're all human, but every, you know, you look a little mm-hmm. bit closer, we're all very, very much individual. But the experience that we go through, I think, from having the devastation of mm-hmm. the diagnosis, and even probably prior to that, where, you know, something's wrong and there's no answer for it. How do we actually put a label on this, put it on a box so that we can understand it and figure out how to manage it? Is that's such a scary experience, and mm-hmm. one that it invades every single part of your life. And that when other people haven't experienced it and they can't understand how frightening, how exhausting mm-hmm. it is to live that life, it's such a relief to know that you're not alone and that there are other people out there to support you.
Yeah. It is. And we've been working with a new genetics company, Variantrix. And one of their guiding principles is that patients and families put so much energy into finding that diagnosis that it almost drains them from mm-hmm. moving forward. And once you can take that energy off the naming it, and you can finally move forward to, okay, now how do I do this? Mm-hmm. And it's such a freeing experience. I know for us, it took years and years for my son to be correctly diagnosed. And mm-hmm. it was, even though it's a name that says, wow, congratulations, we have nothing for you. You still are like, well, we're not crazy. And mm-hmm. now we just can move forward and do what we need to do. And it is, it's a great transfer of energy. And especially in our disease world where energy is everything, mm-hmm. It's wonderful to be able to know that you can do it, and you can do it successfully. Mm-hmm. So
wonderful way to say it.
So what's new with you guys, other than your website just like took on a life of its own? Oh my gosh, I absolutely love your website. What's new? Exciting. Like, what can we look forward to in with MitoCanada?
Yeah, so I think there's lots of things that are new, and I'm glad that you mentioned the website, because that's a sort of a work in progress that we're tackling it section by section, or even resource by resource, and Kate's really the visionary behind that. So I'm glad that you noticed it, and would encourage
I
people
it was
to
done.
Yeah, no, okay. No, no. Like, really? No, no, we're just back. Getting started.
We've started. Oh yes. We have grand plans. So keep coming back and checking out our pages, because it's a slow evolution, but it is our brick and mortar. We mm-hmm. we function virtually, and this is our home. So you know, it's going to have a little bit of a renovation, and there'll be new information, and you'll start to see new programs,
new education resources.
Yeah, donning those pages and. Yeah.
Yeah, and different types of resources, whether it's, you know, education guides that are, you know, paper-based, that PDF mm-hmm. that you can print off, mm-hmm. or animations, or shows like this, like what you're doing. But what's new? I think probably the biggest thing is really the dedication to looking forward. You know, mm-hmm. what are we going to do next? We've had the 10 years and they've been fantastic. So how are we going to do even better in the next 10 years? And one of the biggest things with that, which it's a small thing, but it sort of, you know, embraces everything that we're about, is really to have a new vision. So we used to be very much about finding a cure. Mm-hmm. And we think that's great. And that's absolutely something that remains a top priority for us. But the likelihood of a cure coming anytime soon is probably fairly low. You never mm-hmm. know, because science is just so amazing, especially these days. But you know, what about protecting so that people don't get sick in the first place?
Right.
What about like you're talking about the, you know, getting the identification so that, okay, so now you have a diagnosis, what are you actually going to do to manage it? So mm-hmm. for us, one of the biggest things for us anyways is we have a new vision. And the vision is to ensure that all lives are powered by healthy mitochondria. So it's really a mind shift of not focusing so much on the shackles of disease, but mm-hmm. you know, how do we actually either protect healthy mitochondria? How do we rejuvenate? How do we work best with what we have that is working well? So
I love that. Yeah. because you're right. The cure is out there. I don't know if we'll see it in my son's lifetime, mm-hmm. but there's definitely, we found that it's when you stop looking for the cure and you start looking at manageable, mm-hmm. what we have is manageable. It's not always pretty and it's not always easy, but it's manageable.
So. Yeah. Well, when we went out and spoke to the community, and the community, you know, anywhere from staff to the board, but most importantly with the individuals who are living with mitochondrial disease, one word came up. It was actually remarkable that it came up in every conversation, and that was hope. Yep. We need hope, and whether hope is again protecting people or helping those who are living with the disease, the individuals who actually have mitochondrial disease or those who are caring for them, or hope for the future. That was the word that came up all of the time that we were talking about. So we have a new strategic plan. We've got a new fundraising plan that we're working on. And our goal is really to elevate the funding that we have coming into Mito Canada so that we can increase awareness, that we can increase programs, and ultimately that we can increase quality of life. Mm-hmm. One of the biggest initiatives that we actually have underway right now is a patient survey. So I'll let Kate talk about that because, again, that's her baby.
Okay, yeah. So. And I've got it pulled up just for my reference here.
Good stuff. Yeah, this is part of our community consultation initiative, right? So we've hosted interviews with patients and families, and the other part of what we're, our activities are to launch that, we're to launch that Canadian Mito Community Survey, which we did in January. And I ask all of the listeners who are Canadian to please go visit mitocanada.org. You can find the survey under Mito Life, click on support, and you'll find the survey there. But the purpose of the survey is really to understand the composition of our community, to understand the barriers that patients and families face within the Canadian context. Barriers also that have been apparent from COVID. What you'd like to see from Mito Canada, what we've done well, what we could do better. Again, the composition. So where across the country are we seeing Mito patients? What does care look like for them within those provinces? And the priority setting. So taking all of this data that we're able to compile from the survey and looking at, as well as the feedback that we receive, using that to inform us on our priority setting. So where we've got that plan of where we'd like to see Mito Canada to be in the next 5 to 10 years. How does the community context play into that? And we want to make sure that really we're finding alignment, that what we believe to be based on the interviews that we've held, mm-hmm. is really in sync with the feedback and the data that we're receiving from the community to ensure that we're on the right path, that we're reflective of our community, that we understand the composition of our community, we understand the gaps that they face, the barriers they face, what they're using now that we provide that works really well, what does support look like for them, and to ensure that, you know, we're moving forward holistically, that we're really got a good sense of what the needs of our community are. So that's why that survey is tremendously important for us. And we really need to hear from the community about what is important to them. And again, those priorities that they have in living with Mito and what they would like to see. So, and it also gives us a good pulse on community engagement as well.
Okay. Yeah. Have you guys found...
I think,
Sorry. Sorry, just to follow up. I just want to be clear is that we have a strategic plan in terms of the bare bones of, you know, what are the actions that we need to do to raise money, to increase awareness, to build programs. But it's really the voice of the patients, the people who are living with the disease that we want to hear. And they will drive what actually falls under those buckets. So our buckets are support, education, awareness and advocacy, and research. But we are here. MitoCanada exists to support people who are living with mitochondrial disease or at risk of developing it. So the survey is so important in understanding. Kate actually calls it the odyssey of the patient. I call it patient journey. She calls it the odyssey, which I'm sure, Stephanie, you would probably agree that's probably a better term.
I go with odyssey too, just because if I have to say journey one more time, I might... medication
or something against the wall.
Yeah, it's not quite the same.
Yeah, and at the same time that we're gathering information from the community, we're also talking to clinicians so that when we build that odyssey, we have it from both perspectives, because the reality is this is what the person living with it is experiencing. This is what the person who's trying to provide care is experiencing. And well, and quite often, you know, they don't quite go in the same line. So how do we bring them closer together so that we're supporting the people who are providing care as well as the people who are receiving it?
And that MitoCanada is the community's organization, because we really believe in building together and learning together. And we don't want to build programs and resources for the community. We want to build them with the community. So I think that's really important for the community to understand, is that this is absolutely a together piece.
Yes, that is the key. It's not for, it's with. And so many times people with rare disease are left with presumptive programming, and they're always like, if only if they would have realized, you know, there's so many things that we don't, because we aren't listening actively. We're just making presumptions on what we think would work. And many times we're not even in the right ballgame. And
that's right.
Listening to what people and physicians, we're finding, Catherine, when you were explaining, you know, how patients and caregivers are sometimes aligning and overlapping, then you throw in the care providers. And that's just like a whole nother bailiwick of, you know, you want to get that Venn diagram, right? So you got a little bit of everybody working together. And sometimes the provider is like literally another planet. And it's so hard to get everybody to kind of, to be in the same sphere, and it has to be a with situation, not a for situation. I agree that those are excellent ways to describe that. So I have to ask, are you finding what we call care deserts, where there's just like, for us, the care deserts are basically the Rocky Mountains, like from Montana down through Oklahoma. We cannot find a care provider. Any of our patients either have to hit the West Coast or come into the Midwest or all the way out to the East Coast, which is not doable. So like, how are you guys dealing with that?
I would say we experience something similar. We're in the process of doing a national clinic audit. So understanding province by province, who is treating what type of mitochondrial disorder patient, how are they treating them? How are they being diagnosed? So how are they coming into the system? What does that look like? Are they staying within where they get their diagnosis, or are they being referred out? Who are they being referred out to? And how many of those specialists are there? And we are learning that there are chasms in our provincial communities where, you know, there are some areas where they're moving out of province to be able to get the care that they need. With COVID, we've seen with the virtual space that's helped a little bit, because we certainly don't have the geographic barrier, but if you live in the province, say like Saskatchewan, and you don't have a care provider and you want to go to say Alberta, some of those specialists don't have privileges in the other province, so they can't treat them. So then they're looking for care providers who have the ability to treat out of province. So it is incredibly complex and is putting on another skill on a patient and care providers that they don't have the ability to do that. They're it, it it breaks my heart when we get emails from families who are saying, I'm looking for a specialist. Mine just moved. And there's nobody to care for my son. And I don't know what to do. Mm-hmm. Now I would say it plays to the strength of our community that we can then reach out to our experts and say, listen, that we have these situations. Please help us navigate these patients to someone who can help. But it is desperate. Like it's so different. Every province mm-hmm. is really like its own little country. It functions mm-hmm. differently. Some have more and some have less and some mm-hmm. don't have at all. So mm-hmm. That wow. wayfinding can be very difficult.
And we're a big country, right? We're almost the same size as the US.
And I am amazed at your geographic size. Like how do you guys do that? I have no idea.
Yeah. So huge physical spaces to fill with 10% of the population, which means that we don't have the experts to help with the communities as well. And again, Kate and I have worked in several different disease categories, and remote care is something that's always been such a high priority. And COVID has hopefully been one of the benefits of COVID mm-hmm. is that may actually move us along a little bit faster so that we can do that. Because as patients who are people who are living with the disease and those who are caring for them, I mean, you're already tired. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to move sometimes to mm-hmm. get somewhere and then to have to travel such a far distance to get an appointment. And I mean, and that's once you have the diagnosis, never mind, going to the 10 different doctors who misdiagnose you before you actually get to the
right
diagnosis.
Yeah. We just had a rare disease day in the US, and at the University of Minnesota, I participated with the physicians there. And our goal was to really keep the conversation going for telehealth, because we have seen the benefits of it. And under our emergency use authorization, that could go away, which would be mm-hmm. devastating to the rare disease community. And one of our leading geneticists in Minnesota, well, actually in the Midwest, said for her, it was eye-opening to actually see her patients in their own environment versus stressed out from traveling, getting to the appointment, just all the things that baggage that comes with on going to an appointment, parents having to take days off from work, you're trying to travel with a child on a ventilator, to go to an appointment that's basically just a, hi, how's it going? Okay, let's redo these meds, blah, 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 out the door you go. She said it was absolutely eye-opening for her to see kids in their own environment, how relaxed they were, the obstacles that they were facing, looking at like, why do you have that machine still there? Are you guys still using it? Just really getting that bird's eye view. And she said, we have to keep this in place because what we've asked our patients to do all along is not acceptable and it's not sustainable. So I was like, yes, we finally have somebody who from the clinical point of view saw the advantage of this. It's not that we don't want to travel. It's that it's hard. It's so draining, especially on our mito kids. Travel, our mito patients, travel is exhausting.
Yeah, and you make some very interesting points. Yeah. As we hear that feedback from the patient community is that they're having more deep and meaningful conversations with their care provider because they're not distracted. Mm-hmm. They're arriving to their appointments. Everybody's prepared. They understand what the expectations are. There aren't people coming in and out of clinic rooms. So from that perspective, everybody's getting out of the appointment that what they had hoped to get out of. And, in Ontario, the provincial government had, they did a pilot study on virtual care, and the feedback that they received from those who were in the pilot study, 97% who participated in virtual care said that they would absolutely participate in it again. Wow. And one of the deciding factors to that was if they had a history with the primary care provider or who their specialist. So if they weren't seeing them for the first time and they had a history with them, they would absolutely continue on with the virtual care model because it improved quality of life because they weren't traveling. They didn't have to incur expenses. The stress of traveling, the stress of taking time off, all those pieces that you touched upon were absolutely validated from the community, which was really interesting. And it's unfortunate because we've heard rumors that after I think it was in September of 2021, they're looking to lift the billing codes for virtual care. So right now they're able to bill for a full clinic appointment, and come September, there's discussions that that will no longer be available to clinicians. So they'll have to go back to face-to-face care, which is challenging because a lot of our patients are immune compromised as well. So right. The best place for them to be during a pandemic is at home. And if they're receiving the same level of care in their home, then it just, the common sense part of you says, like, makes so much sense. Like, why so wouldn't much, we continue yes. on with it? Especially if there's, you know, from a quality of life perspective, you're keeping patients and children in the comfort of their own home. So,
yep. It's I hope you guys are advocating for whatever channels you have in Canada to keep that a possibility. I know I am working with our legislative bodies to say we have to keep this in play. We've proven now it's workable, it's doable. Everybody's getting paid.
That's right.
You know, there's no reason to pull the plug on this.
No, and there's true alignment. You're seeing it on mm-hmm. both sides. You're seeing it from the patient communities, the caregivers, and you're seeing it from the clinicians as well.
Yeah.
And then you have the robust data behind it to substantiate just how many clinic appointments are you having in a day? How is the delivery of care? You know, you're doing those quality of life surveys with those patients on there's so many positives that it would amaze me if
they pulled that plug.
If they stepped away from it, I think there would be too much outrage from the community.
Yeah, I think so too. We even had a rare disease oncologist, pediatric oncologist, speak out about it, and how he said, you know, he has patients who travel to him for their initial treatment process and diagnosis, and then they go back to their home. He called it their home quarters. Mm-hmm. And then it was difficult for him to follow up with the care providers for, you know, the people on site taking care of that child. And he says now he can just go right in on Zoom, talk to the physician, get the family, everybody's on the screen together, yeah. You know, talk about the symptoms, what they're experiencing, what the labs look like, what's the next steps. Nobody has to get in the car and travel across country anymore to seek his services. And mm-hmm. because he's one in four in the country who work with these ultra rare pediatric cancers. And he said for him, it's absolutely changed the way he looks at his practice and how he is able to deliver what he knows and to collaborate with other physicians. He said, he's like, I don't know everything. And to be able to sit down and collaborate and, you know, discuss what they're seeing and doing and what's available in that state. He's like, I have no idea what you can do in Missouri, but to get on the phone with somebody and say, okay, this is our options. He's like, oh, all right, let's problem solve together. And I'm thinking, wow, talk about somebody who checked their ego. That's amazing.
But again, talking about deep and meaningful conversations, like you're having those very well-informed patient-physician conversations virtually. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be one of those silver linings that come out of this pandemic is, you know, we've been talking about it in Canada for years and years. And what seemed to be the fail-safe to not doing it was the security measures, you know, the privacy issues around it. But when we're faced with a pandemic and it's an all or none situation, what we realize is the issues we thought we would have didn't end up being the issues we thought we'd have. And if anything, we ended up providing the same, if not better, quality of care in certain aspects. I mean, there's, in some regards, you can't replace face-to-face, especially if you have significant complex needs for you, you need to have that face-to-face interaction, but that doesn't mean that they have to happen every single time, that you can, maybe you have more touch points than with your specialist because you have that virtual option. So again, so maybe the care is even greater.
That's a good point. That's a valid point that there's probably an opportunity to touch in more often than just biannually and then have these big explosive appointments. So being that COVID's affected everybody, how has it truly impacted Mito Canada for you? Like, just getting people engaged, staying engaged. We don't get to have what we call our Mito socials where we're getting people together in the same room. So, you know, we're coming up with all kinds of ways to do it. So how are you guys doing it, especially from a fundraising standpoint? Yeah. Like you said, you guys are like the Guinness World Book of Records for the Guinness World Book of Records. So how are you doing that?
Yeah. So I think, you know, Mito Canada has been really fortunate. We adopted a virtual workspace about 2 years ago. So we kind of had the infrastructure in place before COVID.
Nice.
To really embrace that virtual model. And given how big our country is, we had to adopt virtual communications even earlier on in order to interact with our community. So in that regard, not much had changed. we have had to postpone our annual conference now twice because of COVID. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's always ideal to have that face-to-face, and given it's our once a year conference, it's unfortunately we had to postpone it. You know, and our greatest concern, I'd say early on, was the maybe from the fundraising front, as many of our events were structured around physical activities. You know, we had our marathons, our ultra marathons, our cycling and our spinning, and mm-hmm. those were no longer options because they were face-to-face. So, you know, one thing that our community is if they are resilient, they are adaptable, and, you know, given the power of determination, you know, our Mito community really rallied together and moved the events into the virtual space, and they did a phenomenal job. Like Team Mito Canada did a tremendous job harnessing the power and passion that and mm-hmm. raising awareness and funds, and they didn't just break down barriers when we were faced with having to move virtually. They smashed them down. Like we exceeded fundraising goals. It was wow. unbelievable. So, you know, power of a community, like, okay, you put a barrier in front of us, we're not going to just knock it down. We're going to smash it down.
That's great.
We're going to prove a point here. We can do anything. And certainly Team Mito Canada did that when it came to the events. It was just awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably worth mentioning a couple of those events. Absolutely. Really, right? Yeah. So we did, they'd had a spin event that they'd done in Alberta for a few years, I think, actually. And we moved that virtual for the first time. And I think in some ways that virtual event was actually better because we were allowed to incorporate education rather than mm-hmm. having everyone in one physical space. Mm-hmm. We had everyone from across the country and some people from the US as well, I think. And we set up multiple screens so that, you know, we had a host, we had somebody, so that the event was actually 10 hours long. And we had a new instructor for spinning every half an hour. So we had 20 of them. So that in its own was kind of inspiring. Some of them were Olympic athletes who trained people for the Olympics. Some of them have been involved for such a long time. People, Mito patients, the founder of Mito Canada was actually one of the instructors for a half an hour of the time. And, you know, they raised twice as much money as they'd raised in the past. And then the other, I mean, there's so many that are going on, but the other one that I think is of note, and I'm going to plug it because we would love to have Canadian support. There's a man named John Paradowski who is running virtually across Canada. So every day, I think with the exception of maybe one or two when he had shingles, wow. He has run a half marathon every single day from the start of June until now. So he now has only about 700 kilometers yeah. to go to finish his run across Canada, which for like, when I think about it, it's like, he's only got 700 kilometers to go. So his goal is to run the 7,269 kilometers that it is from coast to coast in Canada, and to raise $10 for every kilometer that he runs. So his goal is to raise $72,690. Mm-hmm. So on our website, you can find a link mm-hmm. to support. It's called the Faces of Mito. But we also have a partner called Birdies for Kids that is matching up to 50 cents for every dollar that's donated. So if you donate a dollar, you're actually donating $1.50. So $100, you're donating $150, which will support all of the, you know, all of the new things that we're doing to support those who are living with mitochondrial disease. And John has a super humble guy. There is absolutely zero ego involved in this at all.
Beautiful soul.
Yeah, he has a beautiful soul. But his focus really wasn't on the fundraising. That's me stepping in and going, hey, we need to raise all this money because money makes things happen.
Yeah,
like,
right.
We can't build the programs without the money. But his focus really was on highlighting the faces of Mito from coast to coast. So wow. We're featuring the stories of people, and we know that the stories are so important, and that's really what we're all about. So again, a plug for, please do go ahead and support John and support us and support you. But also if you're a Canadian and you want to share your story of living with Mito, we want to hear about it, and we want to feature you in that. So, you know, those are just a couple of examples of the resiliency, the creativity, the compassion that's part of our MITO community. And we're just so thankful and really feel privileged to be part of it.
Yeah. Wow. Maybe you could share a little bit about John's passion behind.
Sorry. Yes, I got distracted. Marcia,
the beautiful Marcia.
Yeah. Yeah. Sorry. That was in my head and went out. So John's partner is Marcia, and Marcia lives with McArdle disease, which is a mitochondrial disease. So she'd actually had the disease her entire life, had struggled not understanding why she didn't have energy to keep up with people, always very driven to do that. And is still the same way from the little bit that I know about her. And just working towards that. So he wanted to make sure that, and she got a diagnosis, I think only like 7 years ago or something like that. So she lived her entire life with MITO disease, went to multiple physicians to try and get the diagnosis, was misdiagnosed, and it was by chance that she actually got diagnosed with McArdle's. And you're right, Stephanie, there's not a whole lot that can be done except for one thing, which will actually probably save her life at one point, is that she knows that she's at risk of renal failure. Mm-hmm. And there are signs and symptoms that will predict that. And John is aware of that now as well. And she has some strategies that she can do to sort of protect herself against that, and recognizes and gives herself permission to slow down when she needs to. And that recognition, the diagnosis with the recognition, with the support of John, means that the likelihood of her dying alone in a bathroom is significantly reduced. And we will have this beautiful human on the planet for quite a long time because of that. Wow. So there's lots of beautiful things about John's run, but I think the fact that you've got to think, if he's run half a marathon every day for almost a year,
I'm still stuck on that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So me too. Every time I see those numbers, I do not know how this man does it. I want some of his energy.
I want to know how many shoes he's gone through.
We actually have a picture. Yeah. We have a picture of racks of them. But when you think of, you know, the parallel between, so I think it was within the first month that he actually developed shingles, and shingles is debilitating and exhausting, and yet he kept on going. And I think really that's a testament to his dedication to the MITO community to say, hey, I'm in this with you. I support you. My struggles may end within the year when I'm done this run across Canada. But I'm willing to get up every day and run with you. He actually, on the day that we did the virtual spin, he joined us on a treadmill and ran 100 kilometers. So he was on the treadmill for, I think it was 10 and a half hours. During that. Yes. Yes.
I know. We shake our heads every day. Just like, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. Yes.
Yeah. So we're thankful for John, and we're thankful for Marcia and so many others who support us as the organization that is trying very hard to support them.
Yeah. We really are a community. It's so apparent.
There's
love, and there is support, and there is friendship, and determination and drive and energy, like all of those components that just, really make this organization a beautiful one to work with, the people to work with. Like, it's a beautiful collective. It really is.
And you guys have definitely set the tone for that. Just, we're here to help you. So let us know what you want to do, and we'll figure out how that works in. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I think John is going to need some socks and shoes. I think we need to get him loafers. You know what? I know. For what it is. You just need to loaf around now. Oh, I'm exhausted just thinking about that.
It's quite the feat.
Oh, clever.
Wow. Yeah, there's some eye rolls there.
All right. Well, I definitely think we're going to have another conversation because we didn't get to everything. But I do want to go through my favorite thing called Speed Round. And that's where I ask you guys questions that are just kind of fun and weird. And you answer them. And then we just go from there. So what is on your nightstands?
Candy. Why don't you go first and I'll go second each time.
Is that okay? Okay. Sounds good. What's on my nightstand? I have my Blondie book. So the biography of Debbie Harry. I have a bookmark of my daughter doing this. And I have a notepad with a pen. So in the middle of the night or when I'm, you know, reading, if a thought comes, like my post-it notes, I write it down.
Excellent.
And then I have a little daisy.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. There you go. So I don't have a nightstand, but on my floor beside my bed, I have earplugs and my phone, which is my post-it note. I don't actually do PowerPoints on my phone, but I, like Kate, I only sleep about 5 or 6 hours and constantly have ideas going through. So my phone is always on and I just take notes in the middle of the night and carry on.
Wow. I like that. I never even thought of that option. Okay, so I think Kate might have answered this already. What's your favorite book?
Oh, no, I didn't answer. So my favorite book of all, so my favorite book of all time is The Emperor of All Maladies. I've read it 3 times. Mm-hmm. And it's one of my all-time favorites. So I don't know. Have you heard of it?
I haven't, but I'm going to look it up when we're done here.
I couldn't narrow it down to one book, but I would say my favorite movie is Phenomenon, just because it breaks beyond all boundaries. Yeah. With John Travolta and
Yeah. Oh yeah. That's a good answer. I like that. what's the last thing you've binged watched? We've all been binge watching stuff during COVID. So.
Oh, I'm watching Lost with my daughter.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so I'm on season 5, and I tell you, I remember the first time I watched it, I was on the couch with my husband, and our eyes were red, and it was 3 a.m, and I remember going, just one more, and I thought for sure watching it again, now with my daughter, because she wasn't born at the time, that I'd be all past that. No, it's like midnight on the weekend, I'm like, Jocelyn, just one more. She's like, I can't do anymore.
Oh, yeah, that is a good one, though. That's very captivating.
Yeah. And mine is New Amsterdam. And I think, so it's a story about a guy who comes in to be the new director of a hospital. Mm-hmm. And his number one line is, how can I help? Which I have actually been saying probably, mm-hmm. I think, since I could walk. So he says it almost at the very start of the first show. So it just sort of stuck with me.
Yep. I love that show too. I just, sometimes I'm like, oh, if only that was really how it worked. It really could, right? Uh-huh. So what is your favorite meals?
Oh, I don't know if I can answer that. I don't really have one.
Really?
No, I'm a snacker. So I love my beet. I am. Yeah. I love Catherine Window. I got my almonds and I have my dried apricots and I love my beet hummus and I love pickles and cheese. Mm. So yeah.
Are they dill pickles or sweet pickles?
Dill.
Oh wow. That would be a good combination.
Yeah. All right. And sour onion cocktail onions. Those are good too.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah. This will say a lot about my palate. My favorite meal would be a chocolate mocha smoothie with strawberries and spinach.
Nice. Did they say spinach?
Yeah, you don't taste the spinach, but okay. And it makes it a disgusting color, but it's supposed to be good for you.
All right. And it's chocolate, so
I'm going to take your word for it.
Yeah, there's actually, there's a physician in Canada, his name's Mark Tarnopolsky, who has a new line of protein. Well, he's got it there. There's all kinds of stuff in the line of it, but it's the mocha taste of it is awesome. So I put a half a scoop of there in there every day for my Mito kick.
Oh, I like that. Okay. Yeah. All right. So if I was just going to take a picture of you on an ordinary day, not a holiday, not, you know, a big birthday, where you were just having so much joy, what would that picture be?
Oh, for me, it would be watching my kids walk along the break wall at our cottage. Mm-hmm. Every time I see them, I get teary, actually. Yeah, wow. I love and adore them. So
that would she be, does. It's yeah. true. And mine, I actually, my every day starts with the joy for me. And it's pretty much the same as that. I take about an hour and a half walk, usually along a creek that's near my house called 16 Mile Creek. And I have a 130-pound dog. So he's usually with me. And usually I have a friend or my daughter, or my son or my husband with me. And I love starting my days that way.
Wow, that does sound nice. What kind of dog is 130 pounds?
A big dog.
So he could probably actually, Logie, come here. He's a Bernedoodle. So he's a cross between a Bernese and a Bernese Mountain Dog and a poodle.
Love that.
They told us would be 75 pounds and non-shedding. And he's 130. And he's, yeah, my floor is covered in hair all the time, but he's delightful.
He is. Friends of ours have a mini Bernie Doodle. There is nothing mini about it. That dog has so much comic personality. I think he wakes up every day thinking, how can I wreck their day? I mean, he is just mischief to the max. I love him. Love him. Yes.
They are beautiful.
Yes. Yes. And they named him, well, they had another dog named Whiskey. I have no idea why. And then this one is Rye. So they have Whiskey and Rye. Rye is something else. So, all right, ladies. Well, this was super fun. I'm going to send you out email to beg and plead for you to come on again because we have so much more to talk about. But I'm excited to stay in touch with you guys and definitely work on some awareness things for Mito Awareness Week. I think we'll have a good time.
Wonderful. All right. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having us. And we are looking forward to collaborating with you and with the entire international Mito community, because we're pretty convinced that we need to be in this all together and that we'll get so much further if we do it together.
Definitely. Yes.
So thank you.
All right. Oh, awesome. It was so fun, you guys. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Take care. Pleasure. Yep. Take care.
Bye. Yep, bye-bye. Bye. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into this week's episode of Energy in Action. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Mito Canada. Go ahead and check them out on the web at mitocanada.org. You'll be able to see all of the resources that we discussed. And I have to say it again, I marvel at the geographic real estate they cover and how they keep it all straight. Remember to give us a 5-star rating on your listening app. This helps boost us up the charts. And this show was brought to you by our sponsors, Zogenics. Be sure to join us next week for more All Things Mito. This is your host, Stephanie. Have a great week.